Welcome to episode 12 of the Turfcast podcast. We're back today. Take some questions from listeners and also from our video that we completed, that we put up on YouTube not too long ago. And I'm going to hope today that I can speak straight sentences because for some reason I was doing some traveling this week and I came back home and I just feel like I'm dumb right now. So that's kind of where I'm at. But RD was like, we need to get recording. I don't care what you feel like. Let's do this anyway.
I don't care if your speech is all willy-nilly, Ryan. Like, it's time to go.
That was early. You got it in there right away this time.
We have to make up. We have to do a double here. To do a double today.
Yeah. So how have you been since, you know, you made your network debut, we'll say, on YouTube of, you know, over 20,000 views, which was good. So
wow, I know. No fan mail yet, no hate mail. So that's, I guess, all good. I didn't expect to be in Tiger Beat or anything based upon my looks and my age. So also, I'm waiting for that call. So if you're out there and you're listening, Tiger Beat, please. I kind of already have my outfit picked out for the cover.
Okay, good, good.
A little revealing, but I think it should be okay.
Yeah. Well, you guys can't see us, obviously, here, but RD did decide to, you know, get himself a haircut and a little beard trim and everything. So I think he felt that what YouTube can do to you, I think.
Yeah, what was that you told me after the show? I needed to lose 20 pounds and get better looking by the next time you... I can't remember the rest of it, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah, we all know that I would never say that, but let's just go with it.
No, you're right. You wouldn't say that. I said it to myself.
Yeah. But I wanted to seriously say thank you all to all of those who had questions from that, but also just those who watched and still kind of winter time here. I think that's a good amount of views for just two guys sitting down talking about some grass and questions about the season. So I was very impressed with that, and I feel very good going into the season that we can kind of continue some of that kind of content. And it feels like people related to it, but also, you know, had an opportunity to do some ask some questions to us, and then we can come on here and talk about all those things.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the same thing. I mean, for two guys prattling about grass when there's a bunch of snow on the ground at both of our places, I felt pretty good about it. And yeah, I think the whole point with this and the videos and everything, as we've talked about before, is just try to, you know, provide as many, you know, as deep of an answer as people need. You know, not everybody needs the depth that we sometimes like to go, but yeah, we're always willing to provide that. And then, you know, the second thing is just like we've talked about before too, is being armed with the information rather than just, you know, the quick and dirty answer will serve you better in the long run for sure. So always good to hear the questions and try to, like we said, and like we've said all along, it's just help as many people as we can. And, you know, also scratch that itch that we have to talk about turf, have a good reason to talk about turf.
Yep.
Other than our own too.
Yep. And this is what we do for excitement. It's a Friday night at like 10 between, you know, RD's in Eastern time. So let's just say 10:30, 11:30 PM. And we're sitting here like we should record. So that's what we do for fun.
It's sad, but it's very true.
Yeah. In other news, today I did see my yard for the first time since about January 1st, and that was revealed, and I still had some stripes going on, and I didn't see too much for snow mold problems so far. So I'm happy about that, but we'll see what happens when the, about 8-foot mounds towards the end of the driveway finally go away, because those are going to take a while.
Yeah, my entire front lawn is north-facing, you know, so like the garage kind of pushes out from the house, and it covers that area up, and so there are, you know, if the front yard is 30 feet deep, about 25 feet of that has not seen the sun at all. So it's going to be a while in the front, but it's kind of funny. You drive down my street and everybody on the right side of the street, you know, the north side, or, you know, that's facing south, they're completely, you know, uncovered. There's, you know, there's grass out there. And then all of us on the other side, on the south side, with all the north facing stuff, it's still completely covered in snow. So
that
would
be
a while here.
That'd be kind of a difficult one, because north facing all the time, just even throughout the whole year, wouldn't be very easy in that scenario.
I don't know. It's not been it's not been bad. I mean, other than these situations. So like early spring, it sucks because nothing gets sun over there. So even if you're growing like stuff in the beds or whatever, like it's a lot slower. And that's, I mean, to be quite truthful, I've never like really done any empirical measurements, but just anecdotally, I would say that I hang back a little bit on like crabgrass pre-emergent and everything there because it just, it's lagging a little behind in the spring. It's just not getting the same amount of sunlight. So just little things like that, microclimate things can influence stuff. But
do you have any trees in that area too, or is it pretty open?
It's open. There's a street tree out front, but it's like a little leaf linden. It's more of, you know, it doesn't have a ton of shade. So front yard would be in full sun. And yeah, it's
that's not too bad
thing,
then.
That's the only thing that's holding me back from the making the plunge on the Bermuda would be is it would suck to green up. Like it would be a really excruciatingly slow green up in transition every year. But you know, every year I would have people come by and tell me like, man, you're stupid, you're crazy, this, that, and the other thing. And then come June and July, it would just look amazing.
Yeah.
For like 3 months. So
yeah,
I don't know where I should, you know, just go with ryegrass, right? It looks great 12 months out of the year.
Yeah. I mean, probably that's what I would do, but you know, that's,
I know you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to see a lot of Bermuda this week. I was in Arizona, got an opportunity to go down, and one of the seed suppliers that I know goes down to that area at least usually once a winter time to kind of go see where their products are going and a lot of the rye overseed that they're sending down there. So I got to go down and see that. I got to see a big sod farm where they have all kinds of Bermuda, high-end Bermuda stuff. They're growing a lot of it on USGA sand, like 100 acres of just craziness going on there. So that was really cool. And they also do all of the turf for the Arizona Cardinals field. So we got to go there. And the field is actually where they're growing the sod for it out in the middle of nowhere, like in Arizona, out in this barren wasteland out there. They've got it kind of behind like chain link fence, sort of like they were trying to prevent people to kind of go back there. But there's a few holes here and there. So they're like, we're not all that serious. But they have in-ground drainage underneath that and like a whole system set up for it. He's like, oh, I'd say this field just sitting out here is about, is at least worth over $500,000, like just right in front of my eyes. So I was like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. No, it's legit. I mean, that the sod industry, like we had that podcast and talked with Wes Kanopsik from the Clippers, right? And we talked a little bit about like those NFL fields and like the crazy stuff they do. But that's no joke. I mean, I just had a conversation with a contractor today. We kind of got to talking about different projects over the years and everything. And we were talking about the World Cup is coming up in the States here soon. And so there's some traction getting started about like, okay, which host cities are we going to have? Which, you know, stadiums are they going to be in, this, that, and the other thing? And sod came up and, you know, they were talking about actually, so the Vikings, right? That's what they had a friendly match, international friendly match there. I can't remember how many years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago, $300,000. There was no carpet in there, right? It was just the concrete floor. They rolled sod out on the concrete floor. They played on it. 2 days later, they came in, they rolled it all right back up and they took it back to the sod farm and they laid it back down and grew it in and they sold it again the next year.
That is really cool.
So that's how you make $1 million on sod, right? Is you sell it twice.
Yeah. Well, we were out in this one section that they were growing it on. I can't remember which variety of Bermuda it was, but they were growing that on, you know, USGA sand, and I was like, oh, the feeling underneath your feet was really cool. But then he's like, oh, this isn't the good stuff. Like, let's go over to the Cardinals field stuff. And so we went over there. And they use a specific kind of fibers that they mix into the sand when they put it down. It's almost like, it looks almost like coconut. It's kind of like a little piece of plastic. And he's like, so we mix this all in. And then what happens is all the root system grabs onto those fibers and like intertwines within it. And so then he took a pocket knife and like cut out a section of it. And I mean, it was like, just like a knot, you know, you couldn't, he pulled that out and then he's like, the feeling underfoot for that was just incredible.
So yeah, the stabilization stuff, like there's a lot of different systems out there, but like I'm not sure what they're using there specifically. But you can get something like a homeowner could buy if they were really interested in doing that. It doesn't necessarily have to be on sand. It definitely helps. But if you've heard of a product called Incomat, so like they put this down like in front of the batting cage when they're taking batting practice, like at Target Field or something like mm-hmm. that. It just protects the grass, you know, it's so it's open and it can't get hot underneath and kill the grass. So it's completely open and it's like this fibrous material that's man-made. But if you put it down and top dress over top of it and then plant seed into it, same thing. It creates this wickedly solid layer that you could still like run an aerator through or
yeah.
do whatever cultural practices you wanted to do, but you've got so much more stabilization in the sod. So that is a big deal right now in pro sports and particularly in Europe, and it's coming over here now quite a bit, is the stabilized surfaces. One real quick before we jump into the other stuff that we'll have to go take a look at whenever you get over for the Tour de Turf de Ohio is FC Cincinnati, which is the new MLS team down there. So they just built their new stadium. It debuts here next month, right? And so they are using a fabric stabilized ryegrass.
That sounds very interesting.
It is. It's pretty interesting. So it's basically like they roll out this hybrid system that's like partial turf. So like imagine if a surface was 25-30% synthetic fibers of turf, and then the backing you could punch through, right, with an aerator or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you top dress into that, you seed over top of it, it grows in, and then you've got that same thing. You've got a layer of stabilized material down below it. So it's been in use. That system has been in use all over the place around the world, and it's actually pioneered by a company in Cincinnati like 40 plus years ago. So it'll be interesting to see how that performs. That's their newest generation of it. And so that'll be a real test. Growing ryegrass in Cincinnati. And
well, that's just what I was going to say is what's kind of the reasoning behind, obviously other than ryegrass was a popular thing over in Europe where soccer is, you know, probably the most popular, well, not the most, but you know what I mean? Like it's yeah. the sport there. What would be the reasoning why that's still so prevalent in terms of people wanting ryegrass, even over here in various climates, that it probably isn't that great of an idea, but you know, you can do it kind of thing?
I mean, that is one there. So part of it is, like I said, the group that has pioneered it really and kind of taken it to the next level and the next level here over those last 40 years is in Cincinnati. So that is one factor. Other factor, the same system or the generation previous to that was at the Red Stadium, and it was there for, I don't know, about 15 years, and they just recently renovated and switched over to bluegrass. But they did a lot of I was just selling it. I mean, it was selling it and saying, hey, you know, we had a group, you know, right down the street that grew ryegrass successfully here for 15 years. This is the newest, latest, and greatest, that kind of thing. So like I said, it'll be a true test because mm-hmm. soccer is a way different sport in terms of, you know, ball to ground contact and wear and tear than what baseball is. So
yeah.
I'll be interested to see it.
Yeah, that's what I was just kind of wondering, if there was some sort of reasoning as far as play wise that ryegrass is like, oh, that's what we want, or that's the way we want it to be, or the ball roll. I mean, I can't think of a specific reason, but
I mean, soccer players in general are very, very particular about those surfaces. I mean, Bermuda's a little bit grabby, you know, kind of sticky is what they say. Bluegrass can be the same way, but you know, with rye, it is more of a slick surface. And if you see them before matches, you know, like running the sprinklers and things like that to try and get the ball to roll, you know, very, very well and slide mm-hmm. across the surface very easily. Rye is much easier to do that with just because of the texture of it naturally. Yeah. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
That field that they also did in Minnesota in the Twin Cities for that soccer team that they have, I think that'd be a cool one to see. That one's almost maybe a year or two old, I think.
Yeah, I think it's two or three now. So, okay. Yeah, that would be interesting to get up there and see. And that's a guy who was in golf for a long time. He was at Hazeltine National up there where mm-hmm. they've played PGA Championship and going to host the Ryder Cup here, or did, I can't remember if they did. Yeah, they did host the Ryder Cup up there. Yeah, so that'll be, that would be an interesting one to go up and visit for sure.
Mm-hmm.
More stops on the tour, Ryan.
More stops. We got a lot of stops.
RK, we got to get a bus and a driver. And how much Keystone can you fit in a tour bus?
I think we could fit a lot. Well,
stop,
I guess
every other gas station.
We'll go into a little bit of questioning here and take some questions. I popped a few things out of the YouTube video that I thought were broad enough here that a lot of people probably maybe had similar questions, and we'll go through some of those. So first one is, I'm in the Pacific Northwest, mild winter temperatures, 35 to 45 degrees and wet all the time. If I put down seed now when it's wet and 40 degrees, will the seed rot from being too wet before it gets warm enough to germinate?
Okay, so in the video, I said, hey, get it down as soon as you can, all that stuff. I'm speaking, and I maybe should have made this more clear, but I can't remember where that question came from, like geographically, but I'm thinking in more of a like a diurnal type winter. Like we go cold, and then we get warmer and warmer and warmer. Like that's a much slower and different process in the Pacific Northwest. So that might be one where I would wait a little bit longer, like, because it's going to be a slower and but steadier rise. You know, they're not going to have those peaks and valleys like what we do here in the Midwest as far as highs and lows and things like that. So in that case, if it was still, you know, 35 to 45, I'd wait a little bit longer. I'd wait till you're consistently, like, I'd say closer to 55, 60 air temperature, and then go. Because again, in that climate, 55 to 60 there, it's going to be a much more consistent and slower rise to get to that point. Whereas if I were saying 55 or 60 here in the Midwest, that would be like, okay, we're going to be hitting 65 here in a couple of weeks, like on average, right? Like, yeah, it's just a quicker pace that we get up to those, that next 10 degree or whatever range. So,
which has literally happened, because 2 weeks ago it was negative 22 at my house, and next week it's supposed to be like 54 every single day. It's just like, there's no in between. It's like, okay, let's go to spring.
And it's, yeah, and it's peaks and valleys. Yep. And, you know, I'm not super familiar with the Pacific Northwest. I know that climate. I've had, you know, close family that's lived there for a number of years, and that's, you know, as much as I can say that I actually know. But generally speaking, I understand the arc of that climate, you know, year to year. And that's what I would say, is that you're probably going to be a little bit later before you can do it. But yeah, I'd look for that 55 to 60 outdoor temp and then go from there.
Yeah.
And you can also watch soil temps too. And if you're watching soil temps climb into that 45 degree range of soil temperatures, you can be in the go zone then. Mm-hmm. That'd be fine.
Yep. The next one is kind of in regards to, it says, could using fungicides consistently on a lawn eventually cause the grass to lose some of its natural defense against fungus? I ask because if fungicides are used and not kept up every 21 to 28 days, that person seems to get more fungus far more often than folks who never use fungicide at all and seem to never get any major fungus problems.
Now, that last part, I'm not going to call bullshit, but I'm also going to say, like, if you're not using, like, if you leave an untreated check on a fungicide, you know, program, and I would encourage everybody to do that, like even if it's just the size of a shoebox, leave that out there and watch that bitch get hammered.
Yeah,
like, it's just gonna get lit up while you have this nice green grass all around it. And, you know, even if you're missing some of your windows, things like that, like, it's still going to be a marked difference between those two. Okay, so don't totally agree with that second part, that people that don't do fungicides versus people that don't keep up with them. I would say that those are equal faux pas almost, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and I can interject there for a second, because
yeah, absolutely.
When I had Kentucky bluegrass alone in my backyard before the fescue fiasco, if we'll call it that.
Fescue fiasco.
You know, every single year, I wasn't ever using any fungicide back there. It was an area where I was like, my dogs are in most of the time. I'm just going to kind of do my program the best that I can. But if something happens a little bit, it'll either fix itself, or I'll have major problems in the fall that I'll have to fix. But I kind of wanted to just let it be what it was. So You know, did I ever have any major problems? Yeah, kind of this last year before that whole fescue thing, I did have some major problems. Some years it was like any other, you know, mid-July time frame here with bluegrass where it's just like it's not looking that wonderful. So there were definitely some issues going on, but it's hard to tell like how widespread fungus was there or what it was exactly. But so I think that's kind of what he's just saying is like maybe there's not an issue that like takes over the whole lawn is kind of the whole thing. But definitely I agree with you. Like if you were on a program where you're doing fungicide, like you're going to have a nicer, you're going to most likely, if you're doing the right thing, have a much better result than nothing at all.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great point. And I think that leads into the first part of his question where, you know, he's talking about, you know, do we have issues in terms of the natural ability of the plant to fight off pathogens, particularly plant diseases, when they're consistently treated with fungicides? And so the first thing I'd say there, in going back to your point, is proper identification of those diseases is absolutely critical. And this is one that gets missed. And I'm telling you, even plant pathologists will miss sometimes, but they won't miss if they actually get if they get a sample of it in. And so, you know, the first line of defense, and you and I were kind of talking about this before the show, but the first thing to do is positively ID that. And if you don't know how to do that, going to the internet and trying to compare pictures and stuff like that, it's not always the best. One of the best things you can do is connect with maybe like a local extension agent from your land grant university. And sometimes they know, or they've seen, or they've heard of from their plant pathology folks of what's going on in your area and what might be out there currently. So that's one thing. With respect to the actual question of, okay, if we are treating something over and over and over again, are we inherently making the plant weaker? And the answer is not truthfully, not really. It is one where, you know, fungicides don't necessarily kill all the pathogens that are there, right? All they do, they're fungistats. They stop that pathogen from continuing to expand within the crop, right? Some of them are contact, some of them are local penetrants, like they just get into the one part of the leaf and that's it. Others are fully systemic, right? So that tells us how far and wide that AI is going to spread and potentially protect the plant. So within the plant, there's other processes that go on without getting too deep in the weeds that elicit a plant defense response, right? And there's certain products and things like that that we can spray that will help for those. Now, as far as like the actual empirical evidence of how well those things work as compared to, you know, a fungicide program versus the check, that data is sort of limited, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work that's been done with it in different crops like corn and things like that. But and it's had pretty darn good results as far as these different products. And there's numerous of them that exist in the ag world and some that exist in the turf world. But when we're relying strictly on fungicides, the thing that you have to take into account is, are you applying the right material to control the disease or diseases that you currently have? That's number one. You know, it would be like taking an aspirin for a gunshot wound, right?
Right.
That's not going to do anything. It's not going to help you. So that is, and that too is something else to consider too. Taking an aspirin, you have a gunshot wound, thinning your blood out is going to make you bleed out faster. Okay. So if I have really bad dollar spot and I think I'm going to go out and cure it by spraying propiconazole, I've got another thing coming because propiconazole is a demethylase inhibitor, a DMI. DMIs have growth regulating properties. So a disease that is inherently already limiting my growth of the plant and wants me to stop it from growing, right? We know we can fertilize out of, you know, less severe instances of dollar spot and grow out of it. Now I'm going to apply a material that limits the growth of it and I'm making things absolutely worse, like unequivocally worse, mm-hmm. right? May have stopped the fungus, I can't talk either. How many beers do we have on the plane? Anyhow, but so the whole point there is understanding the pathogen and then applying the correct material. That is what's always out there. Now, let's say you have nothing and you're riding clean. You don't have anything out there. I'm okay with, hey, today's day 28 and it's going to be 75. We're going to have a nice cool stretch of days here in the middle of July, right? Mm-hmm. I'm okay with you saying, you know what? I'm going to let it ride for 3 or 4 days. It is not one of those things where there's a shot clock on these things that's counting down to zero. And as soon as that goes off, you're screwed. It's not like that at all. So, playing the weather patterns, understanding what that's like, and then choosing the right material for the disease you're facing. And so again, the way to get back to that is, I think we can throw it up in the show notes, but there's a really good PDF from Ohio State, go Bucks, of all the residentially all the turf fungicides that are labeled for residential turf. And so those are kind of an all-encompassing list of what's out there, and it's listed by disease. Some of these things are a little bit harder to come by than others in terms of whether it be their package size or their cost. Mm-hmm. But that's the other thing too, is if you're using the cheap stuff on fungicide, I can guarantee you that it can be effective, but the expensive stuff is expensive for a reason, because it works.
Well, and I think here's the problem that is an issue for a lot of homeowners is that, one, the identification, like you said, is very difficult for mm-hmm. those of us who are just like, okay, well, something's happening. I'm not sure exactly how to tell. A lot of those things look the same too. Like, they have the same types of issues where you're like, well, I don't know. There's definitely damage happening, but I can't say for sure. So that's number one. Two is, I think a good thing to point out there, though, in his question was kind of in regards to, does resistance actually exist? And using the same thing over and over, or looking at that list, I can't remember what the resource was, but there's one too where it shows, how much of resistance are you going to have if you use this product over and over again, to where you might be causing something down the line in your turf to be like, oh yeah, I'm fine with that now. Like, I'm good. I'm not going to be taken down by some fungicide. So that's another thing to, at least for homeowners, I think they should understand that just throwing down the exact same thing every time is not always going to be the answer either.
No, that's a great point too, the resistance thing. And I didn't get into that, but you touched on it. You're right that, DMIs, thiophenate methyl, any of the strobularins like azoxystrobin, pyraclostrobin, all those run an inherent risk. The new SDHI chemistries that are out there. You get into a dangerous game pretty quickly of, oh yeah, I sprayed that. Now, I sprayed this stuff and now it doesn't work anymore. The most popular school of thought is to rotate so you don't have resistance. And then there's a guy, he's a noted plant pathologist from Michigan State, Joe Vargas. He's been around forever. I mean, kind of like the godfather of turf pathology. And Joe's thing is spray it till it doesn't work and then move on to the next one. And he's not wrong. He's not. So it's, you got to kind of hedge your bets there and figure out what works and what doesn't. But I'm a fan of rotation and trying to use all the tools at the right time if you can. Mm-hmm. And learning and trying to get some good information. Because I'll tell you that is, you can waste a ton of money and get very lackluster results from just not knowing.
That was going to be my third point, is that for homeowners, especially if you look at these lists of fungicides and you look at the cost of them, you better be sitting down at some point, because some of them are like, you're not going to the store and buying a $14 bottle of liquid that you're going to put down. I mean, like for me in my ryegrass, I have kind of that, if a major disaster happens, I have some mefenoxam on hand, like, okay, but I try not to go down the road of using that if I don't really have to. But even that alone for the cost of it is like, yeah, it's not something that most people are going to be using a lot or looking at the prices and just have a whole bunch of array of stuff of this on hand, like maybe a golf course or something else.
Yeah, and you can look at it too as an investment in terms of, here's what the difference is between scale of a golf course versus scale of a homeowner is the upfront cost for a homeowner is like, holy crap, I'm going to spend $200, $300, $400 on this upfront, but it's going to last me 5 years, right? And so that, it, to me, is like, if you're budgeting as a homeowner, I would sort of hedge my bet. So if there was like one like primo top-notch one that I would pick up each year and then supplement with the cheaper stuff, right? And then the next year, I'll keep the cheaper stuff in there because I already have it in stock, whatever, because I'm still buying it in larger quantities that I can't use all in a year. Mm-hmm. But every year, I'm going to drop that $200 or $300 on something that's really good and know that it's always in my cycle. So that's kind of the way I would build up the arsenal, so to speak, rather than, you know, the golf course that has the, you know, like the Department of Defense budget that's just dropping, you know, $800 billion on a, you know, it's stupid money. I mean, it really is. I mean, this is years ago, but on the golf course, we would spend about a little under $100,000 on all of our, you know, just our plant protectants. So that's insecticides, fungicides,
That's
herbicides, everything.
Yep.
Like that. Go for a regulator. So yeah, it gets pricey pretty quick on scale.
So speaking of that, if we were talking about a cool season arsenal, like for a homeowner, like you said, if you wanted to spend some cash on something that is going to be an all around and maybe then some of the cheaper stuff, what would be maybe an example of in your mind of something that people could at least start to research?
So like the big ticket items, you mean?
Yeah, like a big ticket, you know, like, okay, I'm going to have this and then.
So a lot of the newer ones out now are this SDHI mode of action or classification of fungicides. And so a couple of those, Exemplar, Ballista, and then another one that has like kind of a combo action of that is Lexicon. So Lexicon is Exemplar, so it's an SDHI, plus it is pyraclostrobin, which is a strobilurin. So these ones are very expensive. But the other thing too that I want to let our listeners know about, and I don't sell these, I have no stake in the game, so it doesn't matter to me. I just like what works. That's what I'm all about. Mm-hmm. The thing about these is in many cases the use rates are very low, right? A lot of the newer chemistries are like that. So I would do your homework and say, okay, $400, my goodness, like that seems like a lot. Figure out your cost per unit of area. So whether you want to do an acre or 1,000 per 1,000 square feet per day of control. And so this PDF that RK will link up in the show notes here has sort of the intervals for each of these for different diseases. And then you can divide all that out and figure out, oh, well, that's $400, but I'm going to get, you know, 9 apps out of that one little container and I'm going to get 21 days each app. So my cost per unit of area per day is actually X versus me spraying, you know, propiconazole 3 times over that stretch and it's actually costing me more per unit area per day, right? So you have to have a good metric and it can't just be container price and it can't just be cost per area price because there's a widely, not super wide, but wide enough variance in terms of the days of control that you get from these products to know what does what and how long it will cover. Mm-hmm. So those are good. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. There's nothing really that's labeled residentially, unfortunately, on the contact side. So we're really limited to just Mancozeb. That's really all that we have right now on the contact side. But other than that, I think you can kind of fill the rest of this out with some less expensive off-patent stuff like 5-phenate methyl, which is Cleary's 3336 is the brand name or the trade name of that. But there's also other off-patent chemicals, same exact makeup, everything like that. So Cleary's 3336, 5-phenate methyl is a good one. Another good one, propiconazole. Just understand that in the heat of summer, not the best material to use. Mm-hmm.
Definitely
always the greatest thing.
Definitely had some experience with that myself.
Oh, yeah, I can tell by the sound in your voice that some seating followed that, right?
Yep.
Hey, we've all been there. Trust me. I had this true story is I went out and I don't know, I was like maybe 20 years old and 21, something like that. Mixed up, I was spraying a fairway and I 3x the rate. And this is like July. So I'm literally like on my Nokia like crap ass cell phone calling the number that's on the label and then talking to the tech rep who's like, here's the story real quick is I call the 1-800 number like, hey, we'll patch you through to Tony. He's our tech rep for Eastern United States. Okay, cool. Tony is at a golf outing for like a bunch of golf course superintendents. Tony is not sober. But he's not like hammered either, but he's definitely not sober. And so I kind of throw it all out there for them. And he's got this big Southern drawl. Like he's from North Carolina, South Carolina, something like that. He's like, son, I'll tell you what, you're going to be just fine. I want you to go ahead. I want you to add a little bit of water to that tank, thin that mix out. And then once you go home, I want you to have about 3 or 4 beers, go to bed, sleep easy, and get back at it tomorrow. And I'll never forget that. Like, I was like, Tony, you were my man. I'm going to do exactly that because you told me to. Everything worked out fine. So, yeah. Also, check your rates. Don't be an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, mine was more, it was related to that. And along with that, like mixing growth regulators into those same things, like,
that's bad news bears.
Not a good idea. No.
Not a good idea. You're right. No. Not a good idea. So, I mean, that was a long and winding road on the fungicide question, but I think it was, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, that's a whole
video. That for one other thing you could add, maybe on a homeowner side, I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I'm going to say it. So, you know, specifically when you're dealing with ryegrass or something like what I have that's quick growing, you know, you've told me before sometimes maybe you don't even want to attack something that's going on. You want to kind of like just get more seed down or, you know, like fall's coming in 2 weeks or whatever. Like don't spend hundreds of dollars to stop a problem when you can get some seed maybe or you already have some and you're like, okay, I'll fix this in a couple of weeks. Like,
yeah, that goes back to cultural management. So like if we have dollar spot, you know, do I want to throw down the fungicide and try and stop it if I'm not on a preventative program? Or do I want to, you know, bump it with a little bit of nitrogen and try and grow out of it as best I can? Understanding that that might exacerbate other diseases that like succulent, well-fed turf. So it's always this balancing act, right?
Yeah.
So you're right, though, is like, okay, before I go and pull the trigger on something like that, what's coming up? What's the weather look like? And like, what are my waypoints in my schedule or my season that are upcoming? Last thing I'll say real quick is you can have the most expensive kick-ass fungicide in the world in your tank, but if your calibration is off or your spray equipment sucks, it ain't going to matter.
Yeah.
It ain't going to matter. So get your equipment calibrated correctly, have the right nozzles, know your delivery volume, because on a fungicide, if you're anything below 1 gallon per thousand, it's not even worth it.
Yeah.
It's just not. So yeah, that's a whole episode in and of itself, but that's a great question. It's a good thing to get people thinking about.
Yeah. Cause I think
it's not easy.
As homeowners, a lot of us are like, we're trying to think when we get to this point, we're like, oh, I'm taking this so seriously that I don't want any problems to happen. Or when I do have a problem, I want to know exactly how to fix it. I'm treating it like pro turf or something, but also realize if you have an issue, you're not showing it to, well, I am, but you're not showing it to thousands of people. So you don't always have to go crazy too on spending something when there's a fix for it. And you're not in a golf situation or a sports turf situation like those pros where they have to be on top of everything as much as possible. And also remember that they have problems too. It's not always going to be everything's perfect all the time.
No, and I'll be completely truthful is that we use our resources hardcore in terms of, you know, extension agents and plant pathologists, plant diagnostic clinics where you can send samples in to get a diagnosis. And the last thing I'll say on this whole topic is that, you know, with those plant diagnostic clinics, so now you're sending it into a scientist that does this for a living, that identifies plant diseases. And the funny thing is that the majority of the samples that come in that people are saying, man, this is, you know, this list looks like shit. It's disease. I mean, just tell me what I need to spray. Over half, even more than half of those samples that come in, come back as they can't find disease in there. It's an abiotic stress, right? So it's either, you know, gone through, you know, drought stress, moisture stress, heat stress, you know, some kind of stress mechanically from a mower or an aerator or whatever it could be. And that's the thing is that, you know, we so quickly want to blame nature on things, but a lot of times it's, you know, something that we either can't control or we did control and we've already screwed up and it's now in the rearview mirror.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah, it's always an interesting one, but pros, I wouldn't say struggle with it, but they always, are trying really hard to figure out what the next move is and using all those resources.
The famous RD saying as well is just riding the wave till I kill some more grass and then we start over.
that's the truth, man. That's the truth.
All right, so let's move on to a question about some moss. And again, we're moving over into the Pacific Northwest. And I think this is a question in terms of moss that's maybe a broader question that I get a lot, especially from those people in the Pacific Northwest. But this one is it all right to early spring seed right after granular moss killer application, which was Moss X, which is mostly an iron product is what they said.
It's all iron. Yep. It's all ferrous sulfate. So is it all right to seed? If you're using it at the labeled rate, you know, I would wait a couple of weeks just to be safe. But in terms of, you know, having moss and seeding into it, like there are issues that have to be corrected prior to that before you're going to go ahead and seed into that ground, right? So in some cases, you know, I don't want to say the myth or the old wives' tale, but a lot of times people say, oh, you got a pH problem. Well, and you might, and it's worth doing a soil test there to figure out what you've got. A lot of times it starts off with environment. So if you have a bunch of shade, low-lying areas, things like that, like it's inherently going to be predisposed to moss. So in terms of like cultural strategies to improve that area first, you know, limb up those trees or remove the trees if you, you know, if you can or you see fit, depending on your property and how that's going. Definitely want to tell anybody it's too expensive to move trees. I mean, I don't know what their means are, but you know, it might be too expensive, but in certain cases, that's the best move that you can do. When it comes to the actual management of that moss, right? So the Moss X product is, it'll work sort of sometimes maybe with the ferrous sulfate, and that's kind of like an old school trick to doing it in
I believe that
modern times.
I think Matt Martin always told me, or I heard him talk about this on his little live stream a couple times with moss questions, was just like, by any means possible, get some grass growing. Like, you know, like you said, it's probably a lot of, especially over in the Pacific Northwest when you've just got such wet conditions all the time and a lot of cloudiness, that's the issue in general. There is like, even if you had light, it's just at some times of the year, there's just so much moisture and everything there. But a lot of it, he was always saying, you know, just try to get something removed maybe and just get any grass growing you could possibly try to get going. And I don't know how effective that would be, but that's kind of what I've heard him say before.
Well, it's such an opportunistic, you know, organism, right? That it fills in those cracks and it doesn't need much to grow. Like it doesn't need nearly as much in terms of what grass does, right? When compared to that. So I would be, you know, the first thing is the cultural side of things of, hey, improve, you know, the amount of sunlight that it's getting and improve its propensity or ability to dry quickly after it does rain and get wet, you know, so eliminating shade right there. Improving air movement around the area, and then, you know, check on the pH if you can through a soil test if it's that important of an area for you to grow grass. And then lastly, as terms of controlling it, like once you have those things in place or at least enough that you feel like it's ready, you're ready to make an attempt at doing so and growing grass, is try to control the moss. And so there's a product out there that you can use, Quicksilver herbicide. The turf and ornamental version, which it's not cheap, but it's also a super low use rate. Like it literally goes in with a medicine dropper and the active ingredient is carfentrazone. Very, very reliable in terms of low rate repeated applications throughout like the heat of a summer type of thing to go ahead and knock that stuff out. And then you use that window on the back end of that to let
Matt alluded to, to let some badass ryegrass get in there. That's what
there you go. my that rye. Yep. You gotta let the rye fly. So that is sort of the set of tactics that I would go about. You know, so again, use this spring, get your cultural inputs right. So in terms of sunlight, air movement, so on and so forth, then attack it over the summertime with the carventrazone. Again, don't go out there and carpet bomb it. Low rates repeatedly every like 7 to 10 days. And then be ready on the backside of that to go ahead and do your seeding.
Yep. Sounds good. I think that's a pretty good plan. All right. Next question is, did my fall reno and seeding in early September 2020 had some decent results, even with a shaded yard or even as shaded as my yard is? When would you recommend sand leveling / top dressing? Also, when would be the best time to aerate?
Whew. A lot of stuff here. So, okay. So we renovated in early September of last year. Decent results. I didn't see what kind of grass he planted.
Yeah, I don't believe it says.
Hopefully it's not Kentucky bluegrass if it's a shaded yard, but I don't know. It could be, right? Hopefully it's like tall fescue or something. When would you recommend sand leveling and top dressing? Before you renovate it, honestly. you know, we're kind of late in the game here, but if we need to call a hot route here, can we call a hot route, Ryan?
Yeah, we can.
All right, hot route. So it depends on what you want to do. If you're going to go, you know, Ryan Knorr style and sling out a entire tandem truckload in your driveway over the course of a weekend, I would wait, you know, until like May, until you're like really pushing a lot of growth. And I would, you know, just be careful not to smother the grass going into summertime. But if you can get your hands on one of those nice little Eco One top dressers that RK snagged from a local rental corral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That would be stellar because you could then probably do a couple of those and maybe not go quite as heavy on one. And I know, I understand that there's an expense of renting it twice and, you know, the time commitment, everything like that, but you will be happier doing lighter and more frequent. So just, you know, try to figure out what your total volume is. And then if you've got a good way to spread that, I would try and spread that out over as many top dressing events as you can. As far as aeration goes, you know, you, at this point, I would let it ride through the springtime, get yourself into fall of this year. A couple reasons for that. One, if you're going to do a pre-emergent, you don't want to break that chemical barrier through mechanical aeration. That's number one. And number two, we don't want to compromise any of those newer roots prior to going through summertime. And so we're going to have root decline and everything through the summertime just through the natural heating of the soil and the climatic conditions. So again, not trying to put any stress or extra compromising conditions on those roots until fall when we're in a better stage of root development. So I think that would hopefully answer the question, that just kind of be judicious with that sand top dressing and leveling. Be very site specific, right? So if there's certain areas that need more, just don't feel like you need to do the whole lawn with 3/4 of an inch if only like 20% of the lawn needs 3/4 of an inch, that kind of thing. What about you? You've been through this quite a bit. So
yeah, I would definitely say that it's a big question too, because we don't, like you said, we don't know exactly what grass type, but and we don't know what height they're wanting to really cut it at.
Yeah, that's a great question or great point there.
But height, for sure, that if you can get your hands on one of those spreaders, that would be amazing, because those things just lay down everything so nicely and smoothly that even if you were at a slightly higher height of cut or something, you could at least get something down without spreading it. At that point, is just a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest pain in the butt you have when you have that spreader is just shoveling that stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And
It's not that bad. So
we need to get the RK Amazon affiliate page to get a drone that takes that thing wherever people need it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Can you call them and work on that and see if Bezos can do a solid before he goes out of CEO?
Yeah, I've got him on speed dial.
I figured. Yeah. Just text him later on after the next 8 or 9 keystones and we'll get him on the horn.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jeff.
Well, let's go with a question about vole damage. Our good friend the voles come out after the winter time, and I was looking today when I started to see my lawn. I was like, what kind of damage do I have? But I haven't seen anything yet. But obviously, like I said, I don't have all the areas completely gone from snow. But this one is, what do you do about vole damage in the spring? Should I spray pre-emergent and hope the voles didn't eat the crown so that the grass will grow back? Or would you avoid pre-emergent in those areas with vole damage and reseed?
So my answer here would be, okay, it depends, right? Stock answer. Bullshit, this guy. What do we pay him for anyway, right? Jeez. RD, stop. All right, anyhow. First question I would say is, do you really need to pre-emerge the entire lawn? Like, is that a prerequisite? Are you hammered with crabgrass every single year and you have no recourse to...
right.
To go out and spray a post. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if the answer is yes, I need to pre-emerge, then the next step on the flow chart would be, well, okay, how much of the lawn has vole damage? You know, so is it going to be prohibitive to skip around these areas, or is it just like one little section, like in the backyard, yada yada, behind the gate or the fence or whatever? If that's the case, then maybe you just try and section off those areas. Let's say it's more widespread. Now, the next thing I would say is, if you still want to spray pre-emergent and it's widespread, then I would go about it like this. I would spray the entire lawn with pre-emergent, but then I would go back with, depending on how big, you know, how much of an area we're talking about, probably just some bagged topsoil, and I would go right over top of all those vole damage areas, and I'd sprinkle a little bit of seed in there, right? Mm-hmm. So if you do get any regeneration off your crowns, it's going to poke its way up through that very thin layer, like talking like an inch, like just enough to fill in those little burrows that the voles left. Those crowns should be able to pop up through there and produce new plants and knit back together, right? Or if you have seed in there as well, that's kind of like your backup, right? It's going to be on top of your pre-emerge, right? It's going to grow down in, but it should have enough of a root system to push down through that layer, and I wouldn't worry too much about issues like that. Like there's a lot of seeding trials that have been done on a lot of different studies that going up on top of that is not so much of an issue as seeding down into below that level, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So that would be, if we had to spray the entire lawn, it wasn't, you know, sectioned off to just one area, that's kind of the way I would handle it, is go back up on top of it.
Yeah, and I've had some pretty extensive damage, but like you said, it's been kind of in certain areas of my backyard before, but I've never really had a problem with it. Just, I don't think I've ever had a problem where I felt like, oh, I need to intervene here. It seemed like even if I did a little more fertilizer or something in that spot to kind of wake things up faster than maybe I would the rest of the yard, it kind of just mm-hmm. regenerated itself a little faster. And of course, I had bluegrass at that point, so that helps a little too, because, you know, you got some spreading going on. But for the most part, I like that plan, like you said. Even if you were to go over the areas and then you had to do a light top dressing kind of seed thing over those little spots, that should work fine.
Yeah, I mean, the easy button way is don't spray pre-emerge. Be prepared to spray crabgrass and post, and
oh, the horror, recover your... the horror of that, Ryan. You cannot do that.
I don't know. I tell you, I've done that on now thousands of acres these last few years in sports turf, because you can't, you know, it's too hard to, or too easy to screw up a pre-emerge window relative to when you need to seed, and it's really not that bad.
Yeah.
As long as you, the only thing that gets tricky is like that time, like in May, June, when it's emerged and you're trying to catch it at the right stage with quinchloric, because once it gets past like 3-leaf, like it's over. Like you're just going to have to live with it, or it's going to get really expensive spraying it along with a, HPPD inhibitor like Tenacity or Pylex or something like that, along with the quinclaric. And that's expensive, but again, so that would be the easy button way is mm-hmm. just say, spray crabgrass out in post. I'm going to recover the vole damage and focus my efforts on that in the spring and then deal with the crab as it comes in the summertime.
Yeah. That's something we'll get into. I know we're getting a little long on questions here, but I wanted to get to all these because I think they all have a good place. But we're going to get to a video that RD and I are going to do, as well as probably a deeper dive after that video, maybe on some questions about pre-emergent, some of the things that, you know, get said about pre-emergent as though it might be the savior of all things in your lawn. So there's some of that, but...
You mean if I put that down, I still could have weeds?
Yeah, that you actually could. I know that.
And not the kind I don't buy, like the kind I buy at the dispensary, but actual weeds that grow in my lawn?
Yep. Yep, I know. Shit. Yep, that's a bad one. So
I'll tell you what, that is one of the greatest rackets in all of turf is, you know, the chemicals. The pre-emerge didn't work this year, but you know what? I've got this stuff that'll work in post-emergent too if you buy it from me, right?
Yep.
What a great idea.
Yep. Let's go to another question. I like this one. It says, I've used liquid kelp for root growth. How often can I use it during the summer?
Hello. Okay, I'm reading the rest of this question here. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, so how often can I use it in the summertime? You can't really, you can overuse it a little bit if it gets really, really hot and squirrely out in terms of, you know, high temps, high humidity, that sort of thing. But it does have sort of a natural
PGR kind of effect a little bit.
It does because of the plant growth hormones that are in it, right? And so the whole point is like, the whole premise behind sea kelp is this, is that okay, like if this seaweed, right, that can survive off of, you know, rocks and stuff off the coast of Newfoundland, right, which is a really big source of seaweed and the kelp that we use in these products. South Africa is another one. So if it can survive in these harsh climates, that it must have just the right balance of plant hormones that can get it through super stressful times of, you know, so that's the premise behind it. And it was seen too, like long ago, like you can go back and read greenkeeping texts from golf courses back in the UK and Ireland from hundreds of years ago, where they talk about like literally like taking seaweed and just leaving it on the surface because they didn't have a way to spray it back then. Right. Like they would just a bad area. They would lay this stuff out and just let it drip down into the turf and onto the turf. And that's mm-hmm. how they would apply it essentially. So in the sense that, you know, how often can I use it in the summer? I think biweekly is probably a fine schedule at low rates, right? It just depends on the product that you're using, how pure it is, and what other things that you're putting in there, right? Because you're going to get that PGR response, not necessarily regulating it and slowing it down, but changing and altering the balance of growth hormones in the plant. That'd be another good deep dive if we got into PGRs and just talk about growth hormones sometime. I think we should do that on a video so people understand that there's more at play than just like the gas and the brake, so to speak.
Right, right.
Inside the plant. But yeah, I think that's a fair schedule is mm-hmm. once every 2 weeks and just follow what the turf tells you, yeah. Right?
Are there any dangers though of... Let's say you are at that midsummer time frame and it's extreme heat and maybe you're on the verge of even a little drought or something like that. And, you know, I think a lot of people at that point are looking to some resources of how can I mitigate this sort of stress that's going on? Like, you know, is there some danger there though of just going all in at that point?
No. I mean, I if you're saying of like jumping in at that point, maybe. Like, you know, and not having the plant be assimilated into that program or that regime, right, or that product, maybe a little bit of a shock to the system in terms of, you know, what it's producing in terms of plant hormones, and then you go and change that dynamic overnight at a stressful period, that could throw the plant for a loop, right?
Okay.
But in terms of being on a program and saying, hey, you know what, it's going to be 98 for the next 3 days, but I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to throw this out there. I'm not going to have that big of a concern on it.
Okay.
Yep.
That was a good one. I think that there's some of those little additive things that you can do that a lot of people don't really know. What does it really do, or what can I do or not do with it? So,
yeah, and there's a lot of claims out there with those products, no doubt. But there is some good research. There is some pretty good research in terms of what they can do, and not nearly to the extent of, you know, baseline like NPK research, but enough so that it's generally accepted that, hey, there is a benefit here. How much of one? That's up to you to decide if it's worth it or not in terms of the price of the product. Yep.
Yeah, I use some kelp kind of in my program. I don't know that it's, I would say, necessarily bi-weekly for sure, but yeah, it gets, especially on the real low stuff, it gets thrown in there every once in a while for sure. So this one is, I moved into a new house in Virginia, heart of the transition zone. The previous owner had mulched the entire property. It simply will not do. I have to mow. So the mulch has started to break down. It's a weird mix of compost and pine bark mulch. I don't think I have the budget or manual labor equity to remove all of the mulch. What are your thoughts on tilling in all of the mulch and, quote, compost into the native soil along with other amendments? I was thinking of adding some topsoil, tilling it all together for a seed bed. And then the last part of the question was, or this was more of what he planned to do, which we can talk about, but I planned on putting down rye and then doing an overseed of blue in the fall.
I might cry. Oh, okay. Man, there's a lot to unpack there. Well, okay, I'll say this. Virginia is for lovers, but somebody absolutely hated this fucking lawn. I don't know what the hell happened here. Why would you... Okay, just...
Have you ever heard of that, though? Like an actual full mulched...
There was a... Okay, I'll give you... There was the last golf course I worked at, they had a huge clubhouse that was built new, like right before I got there, and they dug out the basement and made this mound that was probably like, I would say... probably 100 feet in diameter and probably about 40 feet high. So it was huge. And it was all like really, really crappy, like low, like deep topsoil that came, like B horizon soil. And the landscaper that was in charge of putting it all back together, their idea was, well, this has no organic matter. So you know what? We have all this extra mulch. We're just going to put mulch on it and grass will grow in it. And it didn't. And it was awful. And so our staff ended up having to go out there and scrape all the mulch off of a freaking mountain and get this all off. So I feel this guy. I've been in his shoes. Okay. So let's see here. The mulch has kind of started to break down. It's this weird mix of compost and pine bark mulch. So this isn't going to work. Like the only way to do this right and have a high degree of success is going to be remove as much of this as possible. Now, how would you go about doing this? I mean, renting like a track loader for a weekend and just scraping off as much as you possibly can, that would be kind of what I would do. And if you push it all up and you make a compost pile of it, or you tell the neighborhood or all your friends, or put it on Facebook Marketplace, like, hey, there's free mulch here this weekend, I'll load you up, but you got to get it all out of here this weekend, right? Mm-hmm. That's one ticket. And then you can rent the tiller for that same track loader. Go ahead and till in what you have left. Not ideal. Not ideal at all. But you could do it. And it would be okay. The issues there are that stuff's just not going to break down. It's not going to hold much, if any, water. So it's going to be more of a liability than an asset in your soil. Even though you think of it, oh, it's compost, it's organic, it's natural. And like, no, that's not the way that soil structure works in terms of adding material with lignin like wood or mulch back into it, right?
Yeah.
So...
Well, and also my concern is he says that when he says the previous owner mulched the entire property, like that to me, I don't know how big it is, but it sounds, when you say I have an entire property, it sounds to me like it's massive or something. I mean, maybe I'm making that up, but.
No, I would say that. I mean, like, you know, if you're in the city, like you see my lot or my, you know, my house even, like that's just, that sounds to me like, okay, you know, 3,000 to maybe 7,000 square feet. When you say property, like, I'm picturing this as like the Vigoro Mulch fantasy camp or something like that. Like, there's just like, oh, here's the black, here's the red, here's the double process, here's the triple process. Over here we got the pine bark, and then back over there there's the nugs. You got the nuggets over there. What do you want to see? What do you want to see?
Exactly.
Over here, nugget land. Or you want to be over here with the you know, those white stones that they sell those in the bags too. Hopefully that didn't make it in there. The little white marble stones that people use as mulch sometimes. Anyhow, I digress. This is an awful situation. The fact that somebody that likes to mow bought this property means the house must be just like killer.
It's got to be.
Like, yep. Yeah. Like,
but let's go to that, the last part of this too, which I thought we should probably touch on this. So he wanted to do rye in the spring and then do an overseed of blue in the fall. So my instant thought there is, I don't know if I like that idea so much either.
So generally speaking, that would be a terrible idea. Generally speaking, if I had bare soil and especially if I was in the transition zone, that wouldn't be a good idea. The only thing I can think here from a thought process standpoint is that the rye is serving as sort of a temporary seed.
Because right.
Homeboy wants to mow, which, hey, who wouldn't, right? You just bought this nice new house and, you know, Mr. Woodchipper used to live there. So
yeah, I think that's probably more what he was going after. Maybe is I'm using the rye as like a temporary lawn, and then I know it's probably not going to last through the summertime, and then I'll just go to what I want to do later.
Yeah, so I think that would be okay in this scenario, but I don't want to trick people and think like, oh yeah, rye in the spring and then Kentucky blue in the fall. Like, eh. No, like in a general sense, no. This is a almost like a construction situation where we're, you know, seeding off schedule and needing something as a temporary crop to, you know, prevent soil erosion and things like that. So last thing I would say too, for this guy's definitely get some soil tests, you know, at least one. And know what you need to do to put that back, because I'm going to guess, if I have no idea how long that was mulch, but I would darn sure bet that no fertilizer or anything like that was applied. And so what was, you know, mineralized from the mulch and whatever other kind of materials that were down there over the years, that would be good to know going into it.
Yep. Well, we've made it to our last question here. And this one is about, let's see here. It's snow is gone or almost gone here in Southeast Pennsylvania. Plan to put grass seed down as soon as possible on construction damage, but when is the right time to add the fertilizer and tenacity, same time or wait?
Now, this was an interesting topic because a lot of people were, I think in some of the comments that I read, were like, dadgum, he said put the grass seed down now?
Yeah, and they were baffled by that. Said, yep.
So here's this question. Do I put the seed down now, and then when do I time up the fertilizer and the tenacity? Same time or wait on the fertilizer and the tenacity. And the reason I would say that is that your grass seed's not going to emerge, so there's no benefit to doing that early along with the seed. Again, the seed needs the time to, as the soil gradually heats up, to break out, germinate, and get started a little bit sooner than you might be able to get out there and do stuff, because the soil is too wet, the soil is too soft, whatever the case might be. That creates a problem a little bit for applying your fertilizer tenacity. This might be a good scenario for the combo product. Ryan, did you ever use that, the mesotrione on the fertilizer, on the starter fertilizer? It's like a 21-22-4 from Anderson's.
I don't believe I have.
So it's a 40-pound bag. It's not cheap. I don't even know if it's on like Amazon, if you can throw a link up or not, but let me see if I can find it. Anyhow, but it's a starter fertilizer that's impregnated with tenacity or mesotrione on it, right? So it's one pass and you're done. You've got your
There's a Scott's version too, I think.
Scott's does have a version, right? Yep. I think you're right. I think they do. So the Scott's version would be a good option as well. Probably not cheap, but could be very, very effective. Again, other thing to consider here is that the spring pre-emergent program on Tenacity is a two app deal, right? So we do typically a 5 ounce app. We wait 30 days. We do another 5 ounce app. Those are per acre rates. Okay. So you have to convert those down to per 1,000 square feet. But in any event.
Or the fun that we were having where we were figuring it out in
tablespoons. Teaspoons. Yeah. Damn you, Imperial Measurement System. Damn you. I don't know. You know, that's a weird one. We can talk about that. That could be a whole episode right there of, metric versus standard. But in any event, that would be the only thing. So you might get some, if you do the granular and seed into that stuff, that's one effective way of doing it. Doing a follow-up app with the granular, probably don't need to do that and unload that much P and N into the soil, especially in that situation.
Yeah.
It might be better to spray over the top with the Tenacity.
So when would they do that, though, in terms of the granular thing? Oh. Like, when are they looking for that application then?
Oh, yeah. So great, great question. I'm sorry I wasn't more clear about that. So if that was the case, then I would wait to a more traditional time to put down your pre-emergent. So we're going to talk about this in the pre-emergent video of ways to time that up. But I would generally look for soil temperatures at 50 degrees and rising, you know, so for 3 days consistently, we're at 50 or above, and then we look like we're going to continue to rise from that point forward. I would go ahead and throw your pre-emergent and your fertilizer, because at that point, your seeds should start emerging and you'll have use for fertilizer at that point.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think that... Yeah, there should be a couple of granular versions that you can find, but I know that the Scotts has one as well. So if you're more of looking at maybe a store or something, they might have it at like a big box store or something.
Heck yeah.
Yep. So that was a good question, because I think that a lot of people liked your timing thing of, okay, I can actually go out here and get in the lawn a little sooner than I thought. I don't have to wait for everything to happen so I can get my seed down. But it was a good point there in terms of, well, when should I do the other steps? Because should I have this stuff? I've seen some questions on Instagram sent to me recently too, like, well, the ground is still frozen. Can I put my seed down? But then should I put my fertilizer down? I'm like, no, don't put your fertilizer down on the frozen ground. So,
no, you don't want to do that. But frozen ground, you can still do that. I mean, that's the thing with dormant seeding is that, you know, you can do it. In December, I think, you know, from experience, this is completely anecdotal. There's no research or anything to back this up, at least that I'm aware of, is that the later that you go, generally the better success you have, because you don't have quite as much loss and dieback. But it also depends on the year. Like, we've got, you know, real quick before we wrap it up is, you know, we've got great ground conditions coming next week. We've got temperatures, you know, mid 40s or so. It's not going to freeze at night, so you're not going to get that real like slimy layer that's forming every morning, mm-hmm. you know, right before noon every day. Like, it's going to be reasonably dry and then non-frozen soil, so that'll be the go time for us for a lot of different early season or late dormant seed applications. Yep. Here coming this week. And the real key there is just getting that seed to soil contact. So if there's any way you can prep it with like a garden weasel or even just a rake, just to kind of create a little bit of surface area and then roll that stuff or tamp it in, whatever the case might be, depending on the size of the area, that will give you your best measure of success.
Yep. Yeah, I'm going to be trying to time this up myself, because that project that I was going to be dormant seeding that I told you, was waiting for the snow to melt, and that never happened. So now it's going to be try to get that down on there before it turns into a huge sloppy mess of gross mud everywhere. So yeah, that's going to be my, I think it's coming sooner rather than later, honestly, because next week it's supposed to be in the mid 50s here as well.
Yeah, that's the only thing about this time now of like getting out in the lawn is like, and I understand that it's, you know, different for different folks. Like you've talked about before, you're like sitting there like a tiger waiting to pounce on fresh meat, and you know, other folks are, you know, dealing with, you know, family and children and spouses and work and hobbies and, you know, whatever else they have going on in their lives. It's hard for them to get out there and do it. But I've heard from a lot of people here since we did that video, actually, that are planning to do stuff here, like either today they've already done it, which, you know, today is Friday the 27th,
yeah,
or they're getting ready to do it tomorrow. There's a big rainstorm that's getting ready to come through, kind of like the midsection of the country and down through the transition zone and things like that. And there's a bunch of people that have been like, yeah, I'm going to be out on the lawn Saturday before it rains because I got to get, you know, the seeding done and this and this and this. And so people are inspired, and that's cool that, you know, it's still February technically, and people are getting jazzed and getting out there and getting stuff done.
Yeah, I've seen a major uptick on my YouTube channel just in the last week. Like, really, it was like all of a sudden we hit a point where I was like, there's a bunch of people coming back and they're all starting. It happens every year, but it is a little earlier this year for sure.
Now it's because they got to see, you know, your shining face and then my ugly mug sitting there talking about whatever it is we talk about. I mean,
no, my mullet was hidden in that video pretty well because I got my sweatshirt and everything. Yeah,
we do. We need to get like an angle shot of you in this next video that we do about the pre-emergence. So to look for that. I will.
Why did I let Connor talk me into this? I mean, in this traveling that I had to do, I was walking through the airport. You know, I'm thinking to myself, look at all these people looking at me like, what is this bum doing? And then I got to meet with all these people down there in Arizona, and I had to preface the conversation like, I don't always look like this. I reluctantly signed up for this contest, and they're like, they laughed about it, but I'm like, yeah, this is not a good look.
So I saw, I got a chance to chat with Connor very briefly last week on a Zoom, and I saw his hair, and I gotta say, like, yours is so much more of a, and I'm not saying this because we, you know, we work together or whatever, but you got a better mullet. I mean, yours is getting to that like Kenny Powers, Barry Melrose style where it's like, this dude didn't grow a mullet. He earned this mullet.
Yeah. Mine, I mean, I got a little more curl to it, a little more flow. We'll see how it all goes.
A little more. When are you gonna start your mullet channel, like your mullet care channel?
I don't know. I should though.
I bet you there's like probably a whole YouTube community built around that. Right? Well,
my wife said tonight, she's like, is there any way do you think that you could go out to Connor's and then you both get your hair cut like side by side and film it? And then
that would be sweet.
I was like, yeah, like
Locks of Love.
That would be good. That would be good.
Yeah, we need to get that, like, remember that opening scene from, like, Full Metal Jacket when they're just, like, all sitting there, like, 1,000-yard stare, and they're getting their head shaved in the beginning of that? That's what we need. That's what we need. That's the content that we need right
there. I think it might have to be done, so. Well,
I'll buy the plane ticket for you.
I think that we're, you know, pretty much done with questions here today. We were going to talk about some pre-emergent, but I think that's too much of a conversation on its own, so we're going to do a video. Talk about some of the basics there, then we'll maybe move over into the deep dive here on the cast. If you guys have some questions, you can leave them on that video, and then we'll pull some over to here and talk about it a little more. But RD, I think this was a good one. We answered some interesting questions and some stuff that, like I said, I just like being able to have that connection where people can ask and we can bring it over here and talk a little more freely about it and a little longer about it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's only so much that you can cover in a YouTube video to be interesting and succinct and keep people engaged, and that clearly, you know, just from the questions and responses and everything like that got elicited from just that one little video that we did, like I said, while us two schmucks were sitting here talking about grass when there's 8 inches of snow on the ground, shows that it depends. That's always the answer, right? That's always the stock answer. But this is where we figure out what that depends on and we go through the answers. But yeah, it should be fun to go through the pre-emergent video and get that shot and then come back here and talk about it, because I am sure that with the weather coming this week with the 50s and everything like that, people's blood is going to be boiling over to get out there and get some stuff done.
Yep, exactly. So thank you all again for listening. Hopefully you'll check out the videos over on the channel and then come back here very soon for another episode. And I think that's it for today. But RD, thanks again. We'll be back really soon.
See y'all soon.